Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Jim Brown was one of the best football players ever. He was one of America's first politically outspoken black athletes. He spoke highly of Muhammad Ali, but he criticized Martin Luther King. He endorsed Richard Nixon. He's praised Donald Trump, and he has a history of hitting women. You will meet the author of a new biography of Jim Brown. Dave Zirin is going to join us later in the show. I hope you can stay tuned. First of all, our top story today. Here on KUOW, we've been bringing you stories of men being held accountable for their treatment of women at work. This next story involves one of Governor Inslee's cabinet members. The head of the State Employment Security Department was accused of making female co-workers uncomfortable, but he was allowed to remain on the payroll until he reached retirement age. Here to tell you more is KUOW's Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins. Hi, Austin.
Hello.
This cabinet member we're talking about, as I said, former head of the State Employment Security Department, Dale Peineke. What was he accused of?
Well, he was accused of making some of the women who worked in this agency uncomfortable with his behavior. He was the type of boss, according to this investigation, who would put his arm around you, who would have physical contact with you when he was engaging. Not always, but enough that it drew the attention and in some cases the concern and complaint of some of these staff members. What happened is one staff member filed a formal complaint with the federal employment organization, EEOC, and said that she felt like she had been a victim, and that that triggered then this internal investigation where the investigator went into the agency and spoke with 16 employees, 10 of whom described experiencing or witnessing behavior by Peineke that they felt was inappropriate. I should note other employees defended him as, yes, perhaps a little bit touchy-feely, but in a kind of gregarious, friendly way, and also just described him as outgoing and that they said that they weren't bothered by his conduct.
And what has Peineke said about the allegations and his behavior?
Well, he was interviewed by this investigator as well and had a chance to tell his side of the story, and he said that he was dumbfounded by these allegations. He said that he had been involved in athletics and coaching and that perhaps that was his reason for being kind of hands-on and physical, and it was a way of encouraging people. The allegation that he was staring at women's breasts or looking them up and down, not making eye contact or making eye contact after looking somebody up and down, he said that that was completely out of character. He wasn't aware if he was doing that. He noted that maybe he was trying to read somebody's ID badge to remember names because that wasn't one of his, he struggled to do that. Again, several of the women who were spoken to said that this was really uncomfortable behavior. One female employee who was not identified in the report told the investigator, quote, "I have never had a man gawk at me in such an obviously leering way."
And as you said, this investigation found that Peineke was, quote, "vulnerable to claims of harassment with sexual overtones." That investigation ended in February. What happened after that?
That investigation ended in February, and then the governor announced, after reviewing the report and after hearing that Peineke was preparing to announce his retirement, that Peineke had submitted his resignation and was going to be resigning from the agency. There's actually a resignation letter that I obtained through public records where Peineke says that he is submitting his resignation and that he intended to stay on and to help with the transition and retire from state service on June 30th. Keep in mind, this was in March of this year. So at the same time the Peineke is announcing his retirement, the governor's office is announcing his resignation. And at the time, the governor said that they were working to, as fast as humanly possible, to make this transition, that Peineke would not be staying until June 30th. It wasn't clear at the moment, at the time, how long he would stay, but he needed to finish up some stuff, and then they'd be moving on to a transition.
So, Austin, I want to be clear. The state officially didn't say that Peineke was being forced to resign, forced out because of his conduct toward women. They called it a retirement, right?
Well, what's interesting about this, and part of what drew my attention to this, is that the difference in how it was handled and messaged. You were correct that the governor did not ask for his resignation. The governor received a letter from him saying that he was resigning and planning to retire from state service at the end of the month, the end of June, that is, when he turned 65. The announcement from the governor's office described this as a resignation, but the announcement from the Employment Security Department that same day, in fact, minutes before this governor's statement went out back in March, said that this was a retirement and touted his accomplishments over 5.5 years. And there was reference to this investigation, but not in the context that Peineke himself had been the focus of it. So minus or absent the governor's announcement, if you had just read what Employment Security put out, you would have said, oh, here's somebody who has had a successful career, 5.5 years at this agency, is retiring when he turns 65. And oh, there's some reference to some sort of conduct investigation, but it's not clear it's about him. So when you pair the two side by side, very different treatment of the same issue, if you will.
And you say that the governor's office had said they were working on quickly finding someone new, but Peineke did stay on the payroll all the way until the end of June. And why was that?
So part of what I wanted to do in looking at, taking a second look at this and seeing what actually happened after the announcement was, well, how is this handled? So what we know is that after the governor made the announcement, Peineke continued to run the agency as the commissioner, but he did so remotely. He was teleworking. And what I was told by the governor's office is that this was out of respect for the women who had complained. They didn't have an immediate transition plan. There was no deputy commissioner in place at that time. Either that position had been eliminated or wasn't currently filled. And this is a big, complicated agency. So they kept him on, but rather than that being for a few weeks or maybe a month, it ended up being 2 months that he was working remotely. During this time, he took a couple of business trips, one to Houston, one to Sacramento. And it wasn't until May that then a transition plan was put in place, and they put an interim commissioner in place and hired a permanent commissioner. And at that point, Peineke went on leave from his job, stayed on leave until June 30th, when he left state service. He'd turned 65 by that point and was able to retire.
Yes, he had turned 65. He stayed on long enough to turn 65. How much extra money will Peineke make because he worked until that point?
Probably not a lot. Keep in mind that this is somebody who, and this was, he was touted in 2013 when Governor Inslee first took office as somebody who was coming from the private sector. He'd worked in the aerospace manufacturing industry before, so he spent most of his career in the private sector. He left the private sector to run this agency that manages unemployment benefits, is mostly federally funded, I should note as well. And he was, by the way, being paid about $160,000 a year in this position. But his retirement, because he was only working for the state for 5.5 years, is pretty limited. His according to retirement services, he's making about $750 a month in retirement. Had he left in March or April, he still would have qualified for that when he turned 65, but he would have lost a couple of months of credit. So it would have been probably negligible in terms of the amount of the benefit he is getting. But the fact of the matter is that in the end, the timeline he articulated ended up being more the timeline that became the reality than the timeline that the governor indicated it would be back in March.
Okay, finally, Austin, we just have 30 seconds. Does the state acknowledge any wrongdoing? Did they say, no, we followed the protocol?
No acknowledgement of wrongdoing. I think, again, what's most noteworthy here is how the governor's office and this agency, cabinet agency, messaged this differently, how long it took for Peineke to go. And I think probably everybody would acknowledge that this did take longer than they had originally envisioned. It was slow.
It was slow. You can read Austin's write-up of this story with a photo there, by the way, that turned out to be quite a source of controversy, apparently, in the office. That's at our website, KUOW.org. Austin, thanks for telling us the story.
You're welcome.
Austin Jenkins is KUOW's Olympia correspondent. We'll be right back. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. It is a proud progressive city. Its residents might even be a little self-congratulatory about that progressivism, but then something happens that reminds people it is a mostly white city where it can be hard to see white privilege.
I think it's a little bit like, you know, if you've grown up and you inherit money from your parents and then you find out that your money came from a crime. It's a little bit of that feeling of saying, well, I didn't commit this crime. why should I have to give up the money?
That's Celeste Ng, and she's not exactly talking about Seattle. She's talking about Shaker Heights, Ohio, where she grew up and where she set her new novel called Little Fires Everywhere. Ng says she sees some similarities between her hometown and Seattle.
I have a cousin who lives here, and I also have a good friend who lived here for several years, and so I've gotten to come and visit them. And by coincidence, both of them actually had also lived in Shaker Heights. And so I can see some similarities between Shaker Heights and sort of the desire to be progressive and the desire to do right and the desire to sort of live with your eyes on the world that I think is also here in Seattle.
How have you noticed that?
Well, I remember that when we came being told about the composting, which is something that we only have just gotten in Cambridge, where I live now, and that you pay, I don't know if this is still true at the time, I guess you paid for the size of garbage can that you had, and so compost was free. And so that kind of, I think, really, really wonderful and commendable desire to kind of pay attention to the world around you and to be thinking about sort of how your actions go outwards into the world, I think is a wonderful thing. And I remember in Shaker Heights in about 1991 getting recycling bins, and that was sort of cutting edge at the time, that we were recycling both glass and metal, you know.
Uh-huh. And what do you notice? How do you think about that idealization? Some of us idealize ourselves here in Seattle.
I think that it's a really commendable impulse. I think that communities that sort of structure themselves around ideals do so for the best of reasons, that they really believe that your ideals are not just sort of a nice idea that you have, but actually a principle by which you can live your life and a principle by which you can structure your life. And that's really sort of what Shaker Heights does, I think, that it really believes in trying to promote racial integration and racial equality. It really believes in trying to be progressive and in trying to sort of be forward thinking and equitable and inclusive. The problem is that ideals are very neat and real life and humans are very messy. And I think that's where you run into trouble, when the messiness of human life sort of runs into the high ideals that you're trying to live by. Which one of those things is going to give way?
In your novel, you have characters who say that they don't see race. What does that mean to you?
Well, I remember in the 90s when I was growing up in Shaker Heights, and I think this was true in a lot of places, that the way that you expressed your racial awareness was to say, I don't see race, to just sort of deny that it existed and therefore deny that it could make a difference. I think now we see that in a little bit more complicated of a lens, that we understand that to deny race or to pretend that it doesn't exist is actually to deny a person's lived experience, to deny the context in which they grew up or in which their family grew up or in which the society around them frames them. And to me, to say I don't see race, I try to interpret it as people meaning race doesn't matter to me. But it's a very fine line to walk between saying it doesn't matter to me and saying I understand it doesn't make you lesser to me, which is, I think, what they mean to say. But often that's not exactly what they are saying. So if you talk to somebody who's Black or who's Latino or who's Asian or really any person of color, they probably see race and they probably have to see race. There's no option for them not to, because other people make sure that they know they're a person of color. I think this happens a lot also in literature and in film, where we see whiteness centered as the default. Recently, there was a discussion with Jonathan Franzen, the novelist, who said, well, he hasn't written a novel about race because as a white man, he didn't feel that he could talk about those issues. I think it's very perceptive of him to realize that he shouldn't write about people of color. But the fact is that even as a white man, he's writing about race. He is writing about white people and the experience of whiteness.
So what do you think when a white person believes that they don't see race? What's happening inside them? What are they trying to do?
I think it comes from a really good place. I think it comes from trying to look at the most important things about a person, which are personality, you know, seeing them as a fellow human being, seeing the things that you share in common. The problem, if someone says to me, I don't see race when I look at you, I don't see you as an Asian woman, I just see you as a person, kind of means to me that they're then not aware or they're denying a lot of things that I have to deal with in my everyday life. My husband is a tall white guy. And we realize, you know, we've come to realize over the years that because of the way that we've grown up, we see the world really differently. This is the source of a lot of marital bickering because we tend to assume that the world works in different ways. So if we're standing in the middle of the sidewalk and someone comes along, my impulse is to move way out of the way. And his impulse is, oh, if I'm in the way, they'll squeeze by or they'll just ask me and I'm happy to move over. There's a certain assumption, I think, that the people are going to follow the rules, that the system is going to work for him, and that if he's noticed, he'll be given the benefit of the doubt. And I have been yelled at by people who thought that I was in the way, regardless of whether I was or not, basically because they saw my Asian face and thought I didn't know what I was doing. And, you know, down to that kind of level where I realize all my life I've been sort of thinking about everything in that way of saying, you know, I'm going to assume that the system is not going to work as planned, that I'm not going to get the benefit of the doubt. So to say to somebody, a person of color or, you know, really any marginalized group, that I don't see the thing that makes you different is to sort of ignore something that has probably shaped their entire reality. And it seems to me that it's going to be hard to actually reach a real understanding with somebody if you leave out that huge part of their lives.
I can tell you when I've had those, I'm a white man, when I've had those impulses to, for example, delay teaching my kids about racism or, you know, it comes up here and there. I notice my own utopianism. And I think the well-meaning idea is that we're trying to get to this better place. At what cost do you think we think that way in Seattle and beyond?
Well, I don't think that those utopian ideals or those utopian goals are a bad thing at all. I think we can hold on to that. But I think that it has to coexist with, you know, a kind of clear-eyed look at where we are and that we have to recognize that good intentions are not enough. There's a scene in the book, this doesn't give too much away, there's a scene in the book, there's a custody battle over an Asian baby. And the prospective white adoptive mother is sort of being questioned by an Asian male lawyer who's sort of asking her about how she's going to keep this baby connected to her birth culture. And it gets very uncomfortable for everybody because what kind of emerges and what's clear to everyone, including the white would-be adoptive mother, is that she doesn't really know anything about Asian culture and she doesn't know how she's going to keep that in this child's life if she gets to be its mother. And what happens in that situation is the lawyer comes out looking like the bad guy. The lawyer comes out being painted as the bad guy, where they say, well, he was too aggressive. He was pushing her too hard. He made her cry. And I think that's there's a parallel there between what happens in the novel and what happens in the world when people have good intentions and they try and talk about these things and are called out on blind spots or places where they make mistakes, that often that discomfort is too much to sit with. And they have to sort of turn it outwards and say, well, I'm not going to take issue with what you said. You might have a point, but you made me uncomfortable in doing it this way. You know, the way that you're protesting is not the right way to go about this. And I think we see that happening now, like with the protests that are happening at sports events around the national anthem. People are uncomfortable with that. And the reaction has been to turn on the players who are making mostly white populations uncomfortable. I have a friend who always says, I can tell when I'm going to learn something because I become very uncomfortable.
That's beautiful.
And she's right. And I think a lot of that is, you know, part of that learning process is sitting with that discomfort and going, okay, I'm uncomfortable, rather than lashing out at the person who's making me uncomfortable and telling them that it's their fault for making me uncomfortable. Let me sit with that discomfort for a little bit and think about why is it that I'm uncomfortable. I hope that's something that we're starting to be able to do more in our conversations about race.
You yourself, Celeste, are writing in this book. It's the adoption of a Chinese baby, but you've written about race before. What kind are you making anybody uncomfortable? Are you getting pushback yourself?
I'm sure I am. I know that I think all the writers that I know who are talking about race get a fair amount of resistance because it makes people uncomfortable. And reasonably enough, our impulses when we're uncomfortable is just like, let's just move away from that. A friend of mine, Nicole Chung, who is a wonderful writer, she's a transracial adoptee herself, wrote an essay about being a transracial adoptee in a family that is supporting Trump. And she's having a very hard time with it. And her essay, I thought, was really perceptive and really thoughtful and really searching and I think probably difficult for her to write. And when it came out, she had a lot of people saying, well, I think that, you know, you really just you shouldn't talk about it, or you're being too political. You should stay out of politics and you should just stay with literature, as if those two things can be extricated from each other. Or they'll say, well, I think your point is reasonable, but there's always all these sorts of ways that people, I think, would feel threatened by people bringing up these discussions. And the thing is that they are discussions that are uncomfortable, but I think that that not having them is often more uncomfortable. So I've had a little bit of pushback every now and then from readers who say, you know, I don't think what you said could be true. And I say, well, that's okay. You know, thank you for reading the book. And I think that a lot of writers who are starting to have these conversations have also received pushback like that.
Writer Celeste Ng wrote the bestseller Everything I Never Told You, and she talked to me about her latest novel, Little Fires Everywhere, last fall. It's been another hot, dry summer in Seattle. KUOW's Joshua McNichols tells us that years of drought are killing some of Seattle's trees, more of some trees than others.
Ray Larson is a botanist with the University of Washington. He drove me around the Arboretum on a golf cart, showing me some of the most vulnerable trees. First on his list, paper birches.
You can see here's some birches, and you can see how terrible they look.
Their tops are bare and brown. An insect is killing them, the notorious bronze birch borer.
Which is an insect that's native to North America, but typically only attacks stressed trees. And so what we found is birches, which have grown happily in the arboretum without any extra care for 80 plus years, in the last 2 to 3 years have started being attacked by this insect.
Is it time for us to stop planting birch trees in the city?
As street trees, yes.
Planting strips along streets tend to get less care than, say, the garden outside your front door. Larson said you can help a stressed tree, such as a birch, by weeding around the base and giving it a thick mulch and a weekly drink of water.
So birches are just one part of the story. I mean, this summer's been tough on all trees.
Washington's state tree, the western hemlock, is also having a hard time adapting to climate change in Seattle's urban forests. Temperatures tend to be higher in cities. Larson took the golf cart over a narrow bridge and passed a row of hemlocks around 80 feet tall. Most of them looked pretty good, but the one on the end looked sickly yellow.
One by one, these have started to decline in the last, I'd say, 5 or 6 years.
Larson had known this was coming. I mean, last year, the tree put out a huge number of cones. Stressed by drought, many trees put out large quantities of seed on their second to last year. When the end is near, they know it's time to invest quickly in the next generation. On the way out, Larson recalled how, last year, a rare bolt of lightning struck a healthy hemlock.
I was very disappointed because it hit this healthy one right next to one that was already on its way out. So it's like, why can't you just take the one that's already not doing so well and leave this healthy one next to it alone?
Arboretum staff can't save all the hemlocks. They can't save all the birches. They only have so much money for water and labor. Larson's careful to say that they're not shirking their duty to preserve the trees, but you can't move a mature tree to a better location. Arboretum staff are facing some hard decisions about which trees to help along. Here's one way people can help. One of the most visible places where you can see trees dying and make a difference is on Seattle's streets. On some arterials, several street trees in a row have shriveled up and died. We don't know yet how extensive the problem is, though. The city only recently started collecting data on the trees it's planted, according to Seattle's urban forestry manager, Darren Morgan. This year, even older, established trees are showing stress. If you see a street tree that could use some help, you can alert the city. email seattle.trees@seattle.gov or call 206-684-TREE. In the Washington Park Arboretum, I'm Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
Once again, that email address you just heard is seattle.trees@seattle.gov, or you can call 206-684-TREE, 684-TREE. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. On tomorrow's show, the King County executive will be here in the studio. Do you have a question for Dow Constantine? Maybe you're wondering about taxes going to keep up Safeco Field, or you have a question about preserving the Showbox Theater, or something else. Give us a call. Call 206-221-3663 and leave us a voicemail. Again, that's 206-221-3663. Or if you like, you can send us an email. That address is record@kuow.org, record@kuow.org. And then tune in tomorrow when I'll talk with the King County executive just after noon. Thanks for tuning in to The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Three Seattle Seahawks players continued their demonstrations during the national anthem over the weekend. Dwayne Brown, Brandon Jackson, and Quentin Jefferson stayed in the locker room during the anthem to call attention to racial inequality and police brutality. One of the first black athletes to call out racism has been critical of these anthem demonstrations, former NFL superstar Jim Brown. Brown has been controversial in his past. In the 1960s, he called for black empowerment, but he criticized Martin Luther King's approach. Last year, Brown said he'd fallen in love with Donald Trump. There's a new biography of Jim Brown called Last Man Standing, and the author is Dave Zirin. Welcome back, Dave.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
My memory of Jim Brown was mythic masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
Which is messed up because he was also infamous for beating up women.
Yeah, and well, these things are, of course, very conjoined. I mean, the idea of hyper-masculinity and the mistreatment of women, and I think in Jim Brown you've seen that over the course of many decades of his life. And the thing about Jim Brown, though, is that he was always incredibly self-conscious of his own masculinity. Like, whether he was playing in the National Football League, whether he was starring in the blaxploitation era of Hollywood cinema, whether he was working with the Bloods and the Crips in Los Angeles, and in his relationships with women.
What do you mean he was conscious of his masculinity?
You see this line of quotes from him that I've charted in the book over the course of 6 to 7 decades of him speaking about, I will not be treated like anything less than a man. And that becomes the compass for him throughout his entire life, from the NFL to Hollywood to black politics in the 1960s to working with gangs and in his treatment or mistreatment of women, this assertion of masculinity. And sometimes it was used for incredibly positive ends, like asserting his rights against dictatorial ownership in the National Football League, or using it as a way to actually get through to gang members to get them out of a violent lifestyle. And sometimes it was used as a way to tell the women in his life that they needed to take a backseat to him. So that's one of the things that the book really does try to do, is it tries to decode masculinity to understand about how it operated in the life and in the framework of Jim Brown.
I want to talk about what his manhood meant to him and why you called the book The Last Man Standing. For those who don't know much about Jim Brown, except what we've just said, he was an activist. He founded the Black Economic Union, but he was not a fan of Martin Luther King-style marches.
Right. I mean, what's interesting, I mean, the starting point for Jim Brown is that he's arguably the greatest football player to ever live.
Right.
I mean, and he's somebody who has been a part of American life for 60 years and somebody we're still quoting. After 60 years. Now, how many people can we really say that about in American life?
What's a quote, Jim Brown? What's his most famous quote?
If I have to march, I'll march alone. And talking about
Martin Luther King.
Didn't support the politics of Martin Luther King. Or, I'm not going to be treated like anything less than a man. My manhood is not for sale. I mean, these were the kinds of things that he would say to, say, Cleveland Browns owner Art Modell, when Art Modell said, I'm going to fine you if you don't leave the set of the movie The Dirty Dozen and come to training camp. Instead, Jim Brown just walked away from the National Football League.
Yeah, he only played 29. Like 9 years or something.
Yeah, which was unheard of at the time. At the time, it was said you limped away from the NFL. You didn't walk away from the NFL.
By the way, I also remember him limping Oh, and he was always seemed like he was hurt, but he's come back again.
That was part of his genius. And I interviewed Jim Brown for this book, and we spoke about his football style. And one of the things that he did was that he would get up and walk slowly in sort of this limping gait, whether he was hurt or not. And he did that so his opponents would not know if he was hurt or not. He also, very interestingly, led with his left arm when he ran and would club people about the head and chest when he would run to dish out punishment instead of just taking punishment. And that was very different because most running backs at the time, they led with their heads, which is one of the reasons why Jim Brown today, he's 82 years old and he still has all of his mental faculties. Mm-hmm. He has not suffered from CTE or concussions, but his arms are just a mess, crisscross of scars, and he has trouble gripping doorknobs. So he sacrificed his arms, but he was able to keep his head.
Well, we started talking about his politics. It might seem contradictory. What were his politics first back when he was an athlete?
I mean, right-wing black nationalism would be the best way to describe it. I mean, he was somebody who very much believed in black pride, very much believed in black power, but he did not believe in demonstrating. He did not believe in organizing on that level. He did not believe in making political demands. He believed that the black community needed to organize itself economically. Like one of his other slogans or quotes was, he would say green power, not black power. And he wasn't talking about environmentalism. He was talking about the idea of building the economic base of the black community. He spoke and still speaks to this day, six decades later, very consistently a lot about communities like the Jewish community, the Asian community, and saying that the black community needs to model itself after those particular immigrant experiences to try to access what they can from the system. So this often led him to very conservative conclusions about marching, about the civil rights movement, about the black freedom struggle. But it also led him to saying, you know, like, we need to work to save a generation of black youth from street gangs in Los Angeles in the 1980s. So it would lead him in a zigzagging fashion towards all sorts of political conclusions. But there is this consistency of being on the conservative edge of black nationalism and the black freedom struggle.
What was his problem with the civil rights movement?
Well, he did not believe that people should march and make political demands. It's not dissimilar to what Booker T. Washington had been saying decades earlier, that there was a dead end to, as Jim Brown would characterize it, I would argue incorrectly, like going hat in hand to political leaders and asking for benefits and asking for handouts instead of just doing for yourself, basically.
He endorsed Nixon.
He endorsed Nixon in 1968, not dissimilarly from how he backed Trump in 2016. But I'll tell you what's very interesting about his endorsement of Richard Nixon is that he wasn't the only black celebrity to do so.
No.
And yet when I looked through the black press in 1968, and I looked through it very assiduously going in the archives, I couldn't find any criticism of him for doing so. While there was a lot of criticism of celebrities like Sammy Davis Jr. and James Brown for endorsing Richard Nixon, yet Jim Brown was left alone. And I think that is one of the things I talk about in the book a great deal, is that speaks to the power of his iconography. I mean, we're talking a great deal about his politics right now, but the starting point is that he was this representation, what Kevin Blackstone called the emperor of black masculinity, in a way that seemed unassailable and certainly not something that one would criticize.
But I'm sure plenty of people must have criticized it, starting with women, I assume?
Less than we think.
Really?
I mean, it started to build in the 1990s. I mean, so it took 35 years after the first time allegations of violence against women were levied against him. It took to the mid-90s when he was arrested for destroying the car of his wife, and she called the police, and he was given community service, and he chose instead to go to prison and went on a hunger strike because he said, they're trying to take my manhood by having me do community service. I'd sooner go to jail, and I'm not going to eat in protest. So what's happening, he actually lost a ton of weight in jail in the 1990s. When that happened, going back and looking at the archives, he did receive a great deal of criticism, and a spotlight was put on the allegations that had existed against him over the course of decades.
Again, the book is Jim Brown, Last Man Standing, and the author is Dave Zirin. Why do you call him Last Man Standing? That sounds almost like a tribute.
it's meant to be ironic and double-edged. Yeah. I mean, on the one hand, he absolutely is the last man standing if you're talking about the generation of political athletes from which he comes. And he certainly is seen on the Mount Rushmore of athletes like Muhammad Ali, of athletes like Arthur Ashe, Bill Russell, who's, of course, alive and well and still outspoken on Twitter. But still, like last man standing, Jim Brown, the person who's still active, still speaking out in his 80s. And also last man standing because Jim Brown was part of a historic meeting after Muhammad Ali won his title against Sonny Liston, where in a what was known as a motel on the black side of town, sitting in a room, you had Muhammad Ali, Jim Brown, Sam Cooke, the singer, and Malcolm X. And of those four, Sam Cooke and Malcolm X were both dead within a year of that meeting. And of course, Muhammad Ali has passed on as well. So that was one of the reasons I called it Last Man Standing. The other reason does have to do with this outmoded kind of masculinity, which I'm very critical of in the book, this idea that you have to be a real man with everything that's assumed in that, and masculinity needs to be projected as a way to build up manhood as being something critical for human liberation. And so that's another reason I call it Last Man Standing, like the last of a certain kind of manhood, but also he really is the last person of a generation who's still politically outspoken, even if I don't agree with those politics.
He's been speaking about modern black athlete activism, including Colin Kaepernick and others, kneeling while the national anthem's being played, walking off the field, etc. Here's a bit of Jim Brown talking about why he's skeptical of these demonstrations calling attention to police violence.
If you have a cause, I think you should organize it, present it in a manner where it's not only you standing sitting on one knee, but a lot of people that is going to get behind each other and do something about it. If I ask you one question, who is calling on to follow what he's talking about? So many of us have always done it, and we're here to help anyone that wants to do it. But I would advise a young man, if you're a football player, play football.
Wow. I can't imagine what the Jim Brown of age 25 would think of the Jim Brown of age 82 who would say that. I mean, this idea that you either have to choose between being a football player or an activist. I mean, that's just something that Jim Brown himself in his 20s would have rejected.
I took him to say, you can talk about another role later, but right now, your role, you're not the boss.
Your role is to just make money and not play football. But Jim Brown, when he played, believed strongly in organizing his locker room, organizing for player rights on the team, even organizing against his coach when he felt like his coach was being unfair or unjust. And the other thing that's frustrating about that sound clip is that Jim Brown, over the last 30 years, has had sort of his own cottage industry of criticizing athletes for not being political. And I mean, and I quote through the book, like from the late 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s to the aughts. I mean, as recently as a couple years ago, going after Kobe Bryant for not being political and saying like, if we, you know, were organizing back in the 60s, we would have rejected somebody like Kobe Bryant, who was never saying anything. So he spent so many years criticizing political athletes. And now we have this renaissance of political athletes, yet his response is to give them the back of his hand. That's also very frustrating because I just want to say, Mr. Brown, isn't this what you've been asking for so many years? Now it's finally happening. But I think the reason why he's against it is less because of what he said. I actually don't think he's against it because he thinks, well, you should just play football and decide whether you're one or the other. I think it's because he disagrees with what Colin Kaepernick's actually fighting for, which is standing up against police violence, as opposed to doing what Jim Brown thinks athletes should do, which is pool their economic resources and try to build their power through that manner.
Yeah, Jim Brown did talk about his feelings on demonstrations around the anthem and the flag. Let's listen to a little more of that.
But I'm going to give you the real deal. I'm an American. I don't desecrate my flag and my national anthem. I'm not going to do anything against the flag and the national anthem. I'm going to work within those situations. But this is my country, and I'll work out the problem, but I'll do it in an intelligent manner.
You see, there's a political argument there that Jim Brown is making. It's not just about him saying, well, you can't be an activist and an athlete at the same time. He said, I'm going to be straight with you. And then he finally got to the real issue, which is that he sees staging demonstrations during the anthem as he put it, a desecration, when I think other people would see it as a very important step, because what you're doing is you're making an argument at the gap between what we're told the anthem represents and the reality of the black experience in the United States. And that's precisely what's made these demonstrations so catalytic and so powerful, and why they've spread from middle schools to high schools to the pros. And so the very reason why they make someone like Jim Brown upset is also the very reason why they're effective.
But it can't be that Jim Brown hasn't thought about that and hasn't been told by these athletes, we're not desecrating the flag. So I can't tell whether he's being pragmatic about saying, look, the public is not going to get behind that, or where he's coming from.
No, it's not that he's being pragmatic because the public isn't going to get behind it. It's that he's part of that public that isn't getting behind it. He is politically offended by what they're doing. Yes, I know, and I know this for a fact because I know that he's spoken to Colin Kaepernick. It's been made very clear to him why they are doing it. He still sees it as a desecration, especially because, as he said, he doesn't think that it's intelligent, that's his word, to demonstrate in such a manner, because then you're not working within the system, which is, as he sees it, the only way to make actual progress. So that's what really offends him, is that he thinks the strategy of doing it this way is going to hit a dead end. And politically, I think it really does offend him, precisely because strategically he doesn't see it going anywhere.
That's so interesting how that theme runs through his life. You've got to work within the system, from endorsing Nixon to Trump and his feelings about the anthem protest.
Building small businesses. As a political action.
Yeah, because some people might see a conflict with, you know, he's the ultimate emperor of masculinity, as if he's a do-it-all-yourself person. But I heard him say, I wasn't the quarterback, I was the running back.
Yeah.
Like, I know my place in the system.
And that's also the contradiction, though, specifically of black masculinity, because black masculinity has often been used as a cudgel against racism in this country. In a society that paints black men as boys, it has been a way to say, no, I am a man. Think about the slogan of the 1968 Memphis sanitation worker strike, which was, I am a man. And so Jim Brown has taken that and appropriated that, but he's also appropriated the worst aspects of when you say, I am a man, which can also mean I am a man. That means you have to approach things with intelligence within the system. I am a man. That means women should take a backseat to what I'm saying. I am a man. Therefore, I will not brook any dissent, and I will not work with this next generation of athletes that's trying to find their way.
Colin Kaepernick is not playing football, hasn't since 2016. And there's an arbitrator deciding on a grievance that Kaepernick's filed against NFL owners, the bosses, for conspiring to keep him out of the league. Couldn't you argue that Jim Brown has been proven right about what Colin Kaepernick could achieve with that?
Well, I mean, but that's part of what's so frustrating, is that Jim Brown should be an advocate for Colin Kaepernick and say there's no reason why he should not be playing just because of his political ideas. If people had said that about Jim Brown when he was playing, Jim Brown was writing columns in the Cleveland Plain Dealer, the main newspaper of Cleveland, while he was an active athlete defending Muhammad Ali's joining of the Nation of Islam.
That's right.
Now, what if Jim Brown had been ostracized from the NFL for statements like that? But that didn't happen. And so he should be standing up and saying, wait a minute, some of the things I was standing for would make some of these guys today blush. And the real difference between now and then is that now the NFL is this multi-billion dollar global business. And then there was just that the stakes were not as high in terms of repelling fans, repelling sponsors, and all the rest of it. And he should be standing in solidarity with Colin Kaepernick right now, not actually justifying why Colin Kaepernick does not have work.
Well, you interviewed Jim Brown for this book, although he didn't want to talk about everything you wanted to talk about.
No, that's true. I was able to interview him over the course of about 5 days out in Los Angeles. I stayed in a little cabana underneath his pool and at his house 2 miles up the West Hollywood Hills. And when he felt like talking, we talked. And when he didn't feel like talking, we didn't. So it wasn't like we spoke for 5 days. It was over the course of 5 days, whenever he felt like talking, I was able to sit down with him. And there were a lot of issues with which he would not engage with, particularly around the issues of violence against women. But the part where I was able to get a lot from him was, first of all, firsthand accounts of things like that meeting with Muhammad Ali, Sam Cooke, and Malcolm X, which is invaluable, just getting his memories of that, him being the last man standing from that meeting. But also I asked him, like, in his mind, what does make a man? And he spoke about the importance of a family, the importance of financial independence. And then he said, but you don't dance. You never dance. And I think about that a lot because on one level, he's saying you don't dance, meaning you don't tap dance. You don't act like some sort of jive entertainer. But on the other hand, what he's also saying by you don't dance, it has to do with this mode of manhood that says, you know, you don't show any vulnerability whatsoever.
Again, the book is Last Man Standing, about Jim Brown, one of the greatest NFL players of all time. Jim Brown voted for Hillary Clinton mm-hmm. for president. Why is he such a fan of Trump's?
I think he's a fan of Trump because Donald Trump requested to meet with him, and he met with Donald Trump and another football player named Ray Lewis. Promises were made, and Jim Brown left that meeting singing the praises of Donald Trump. Now, I'm of a believer that one of the reasons why he's also praising Donald Trump is two reasons. One is that people like John Lewis and that generation of civil rights activists have obviously been against Donald Trump from the beginning. And Jim Brown's always had an antipathy towards people who are part of, as he puts it, parades, which is how he refers to
it. Yeah, he wouldn't call them
marches.
He called them parades.
Yeah. So that's one reason. The other reason is that, you know, President Barack Obama never sought Jim Brown's counsel and never invited him to the White House, even though President Obama loved being around, for example, one of Jim Brown's oldest friends, Bill Russell. Mm-hmm. And I think that wounded Jim Brown a great deal. So to have the president-elect, Donald Trump, actually request a meeting with him, I mean, I think that that's really all it took, like this idea of feeling relevant. And then it wasn't just about that one meeting, but Jim Brown also held like this event on the day of the inauguration, like this huge party in D.C. So it's not like he was this wilting flower after Trump started to aggressively speak in ways that were, in particular, denigrating NFL players. Jim Brown has been conspicuously silent about Donald Trump calling NFL players SOBs, saying that they should be fired if they protest during the anthem. Instead, Jim Brown's response of that has been, yeah, they shouldn't protest during the anthem.
Why do you think Obama stayed away from Jim Brown?
I think President Obama stayed away from Jim Brown because of the history of allegations of violence against women. I think that there is a lot of image consciousness in that White House, and Jim Brown was a casualty of that, and it wounded him very deeply. Partly because Jim Brown thinks a lot of the accusations that he's faced over the decades have been absolute hogwash and things that have been ginned up by the media because he is a strong black man, and to use his words, they're trying to take away his manhood.
Dave, you co-wrote a book with former Seahawks star Michael Bennett,
mm-hmm.
Things That Make White People Uncomfortable. Bennett is also talking about what makes a man. Right.
Yeah. But he comes at it from an entirely different direction.
Yeah.
I mean, it was so interesting to work on these two books at the same time and to have them come out just a few weeks apart from one another. I mean, other than that, it was kind of exhausting. But the part about it that was really interesting was that I think Michael Bennett's kind of manhood is so at opposition with Jim Brown's. Like, I would speak to Jim Brown at his house, and Jim Brown was just this hardened mask of invulnerability. Like, he wouldn't give anything. While Michael Bennett, it's like you speak to him and Michael Bennett will cry while he speaks about his own mother. He'll cry when he speaks about his family. He'll cry when he speaks about his daughters. And he does it without fear of being mocked or insulted. He's utterly unselfconscious about how he defines his own masculinity. And that makes him very different from Jim Brown.
You know, Dave, I hear a frustration from you with Jim Brown, and I wonder, I can understand you writing a book about Michael Bennett. Why did you decide to invest all the time and energy in giving voice to Jim Brown?
Took 5 years. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you, Bill. I ask myself that very question about why did I take all this time to do this? And I think what it comes down to is two things. One, there'd only been one other biography written about Jim Brown. The other reason why I did it was, so many people I knew were, and this happened after I'd been years into writing the book, but so many people I knew were absolutely heartbroken when Jim Brown came out in support of Donald Trump. They couldn't understand it. They couldn't believe it. How could the great Jim Brown do this? And part of what I argue with the book is like, well, actually, if we've been paying attention to the last 50 years, there is a roadmap that gets Jim Brown to Donald Trump. And I wanted to write about that roadmap because it had never been written about before. Now, there is also at the same time this frustration because, you know, I've devoted my professional life to writing about athletes who inspire us to struggle for a better world. And I don't think Jim Brown is in that category of people at this point. He may have been at one time, but certainly not in 2018. And, you know, that puts me in a difficult situation as a writer, as a biographer, of saying the life of somebody who did heroic things but is not necessarily a hero, to use the words of another author, Howard Bryant, in describing Jim Brown, is a difficult thing to try to represent. It's like, read about this person because he's not a hero, and that makes his life worth understanding and knowing.
Dave, I have to say, there are still athletes hitting women. Do you really think Jim Brown is anywhere near the last man standing in the sense that you meant that?
He's the last man standing in terms of someone who came up of a generation where this kind of masculinity was valorized. In that regard, I think he is the last man standing. And I think that we are going to be better off as we critically examine that generation and think about new ways to construct masculinity and think about our relationships. And like, for example, I went back and looked at the press coverage of some of the trials that he went through, or police investigations around violence against women. And I do think that we've made progress in terms of how we report on these issues. But we still have a long ways to go. But I mean, if people who think that there's been no progress over the last 50 years, I would encourage them to actually go back and look at the press clippings for how these kinds of issues were discussed at the time. It's quite shocking and quite educational.
Dave Zirin is the author of Jim Brown, Last Man Standing. Good to see you again. Thank you, Dave.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks.
And thank you for tuning into The Record, produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jima Brempong, Allison Bruzek, Sophie Reed, and Jason Pagano, and our social media producer, Kara McDermott. Tomorrow on The Record, King County Executive Dow Constantine. See you then.